This is the Global Podcast Network, where executives and professionals connect, share, and inspire. Stay tuned for the conversations that drive success.
You know, it's amazing how things change in our lives and our cultures, but then they really don't. And what do I mean by that? Our next guest is doing what people did thousands of years ago, and it still resonates, and it's even on social media and all of that. It comes down to one thing, a story. You read a post, it's really a story that you're, it's a short one, very short one, but it's still a story. She's a professional storyteller and author. And as I said, what's going on now, which she does, same thing that they were doing years ago. So great to have Carolyn Marshall Stearns back with us. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you.
You've been busy, especially because of Halloween this season and lots of stories that can come from that. You got something going on tonight. You're in Connecticut. What do you got going on?
So tonight is a lantern walk, historic site, the Strong Porter House, which is adjacent to the Nathan Hale homestead. Nathan Hale, our American Revolution patriot spy that the British killed. This is his grandmother's homestead, and it's diagonally across the street from where his family lived, and directly across the street from his best friend, Asher Wright's home. That house is now gone, and there is only the foundation and a stone in their memory of that friendship. He never really recovered from losing Nathan, and he came home and lived another 60 years and missing a dear, dear friend. But I will be walking in colonial costume with my candle lantern in hand and taking them around and telling at the blacksmith shop a blacksmith story. And at the herb garden, there was a famous herbalist, Adelma Grenier Simmons, who lived in that town as well. And so I'll be doing a story in her honor of the stinging nettles plant and how that played in fairy tale.
Wow.
And then we have the historic town hearses that will have a part in a story. And so it all plays back to the work and the research I've done in history and engaging people in knowing where history is right near them and getting them attached to a museum because they can come to a fun event there.
Did you say historic hearses?
Yes, horse-drawn hearses, one from the North Church and one from the South Church, both in their original town, and they've been completely restored.
Wow. It's a, you know, this is like your feeding, your feeding ground because of the history, because of the story. Nathan Hale. So I grew up on Long Island. I think there's a connection to Long Island, obviously.
Yes,
right across.
He was on Long Island when he was captured.
I knew it.
He was portraying a Dutch schoolmaster and collecting armament counts of cannon and soldiers and what was George Washington's army up against.
There, and you know what? That must be connected with what we have here called the Spy Trail, where it goes for many miles, and it's the trail where the spies, you know, did their thing. And there's even markers on the trail. And actually, if you were to get on the ferry and head across to Long Island, within a couple of miles, you'd be on the spy trail. It's right there. It's right there. Wow. So you have a lot of great books, one of them 13 Spooky Stories. And is this one that you're going to be reading tonight?
So when I do a performance, there's no books involved. Everything's in here. Everything is personally related. It's the traditional oral storytelling.
Yeah.
Now, I have written a historical fiction piece in the book 13 Spooky Stories about Nathan Hale and Asher Wright. And we are going to set that stage with some historical society members dressed in costume, disappearing into the woods on a hunting trip as it comes out of the story that way. And wow. There will be swinging lanterns in the night. And so that was a signal that I put into the story. And the reason to write that historical fiction is to let people see themselves engaged in the history.
How do we know what is fiction and what is not? Like, you talk about the swinging of the lanterns. It sounds very reasonable that that was a way to send a signal back then. Was that real?
Yeah, I think so. And especially between a couple of boys to, you know, a farm field away.
Yeah.
That they would have swung a lantern and, you know, hey, I'm ready. And the lantern swings. And then the other one replies with the same, too far to shout. And you don't want your parents to know if you're up to mischief.
And hundreds of years ago, we didn't have streetlights. It was dark. So the only thing you saw sometimes for miles, that could be that lantern. Wow. Are you going to read the Nathan Hale passage from the book?
I could. Let me see how quick I can find it.
No worries. But even, you know, before we get there, when you're out telling a story, how much of it is already pre-planned in your head? You know, maybe a percentage of what is pre-planned, right? And the rest is, well, I'm just making it up as I go along. What do you feel?
So I plan what stories I'm telling, and I pretty much know them in my head. I could forget a section, but nobody's going to know that. I'll go back and say, but what you didn't know is that this happened previously, and I can fix things because it's live and on the spot, and there's no script. So it's all done. I can also like back off the fear factor this time of year. If somebody looks truly frightened, mm-hmm. then we're going to add some lightness to it. And because it's my duty to take care of my audience.
Well, so, it's fictional history. So I would have to think that anything goes. Yeah, it'd be cool to have a little bit of history infused in the story. But short of that, you know, but whether there was three horses or two, whether, you know, somebody ate, you know, freshly baked bread or found it in, you know, in a garbage can, it doesn't matter because there is an element of fiction in there.
Right. And we can't know what their conversations were. There's no recordings. There's some writings, some diaries, and I love old letters, which we can get to in a few minutes. But we can't know that. So if we want to share conversation, which is, you know, we like reading conversation and hearing people's words, then it becomes fiction instantly because you have to presume the conversation and make that up.
Gotcha. That sounds so exciting. Like tonight, that sounds like a fun
And
fun
we got
event.
Great weather for it. It's going to be a crisp night, but they're going to have hot cider and cocoa afterwards and home baked goodies in the barn. And it'll be fun.
How much walking is done in that? Is it a little, any distance, or is it?
No, it's around the yard. So there's the house museum, the gardens to one side of it, the blacksmith shop's on the far end on the lawn. The barn is directly behind it. It's a smaller barn. The big barn on that site burned, and that will also be a part of the story tonight when somebody comes running to bang on the door and yell, the barn's on fire.
You are like a history sponge.
Yeah, I love it.
Seriously. Like, you remember all of this stuff. Yeah, I have a good memory. I'm going to be honest with you. Lately, I've been shutting it off a little bit because it's sometimes overloading and I just want to focus on now. But you're wired to, you know, just pull this stuff up, which is amazing. It's a passion.
And it's so fun. And sometimes things happen. I once was telling a story at a historic museum. We were on the lawn. And just as I got to the part of the story where a church bell rang, the adjacent church bell started ringing, totally unplanned.
Wow.
I waited for it to toll the four times. It was 4 o'clock and the sound died out. And then I jumped right back into the story, kept right on going. And everybody pounced at the end, like, how did you do that? I'm like, oh, no. That's a gift. That's a storytelling gift.
There are no coincidences in my estimation. There's energy. We, you know, your stories are energy. Something went out into the universe to ring that bell.
So in the story of Nathan and Asher, which is the opening story in the book. And so at age 14, I was a docent in the Nathan Hale homestead. I already understood the family story and the 18th century living because I was raised that way in a 1751 colonial home. So I jumped right into being able to help as a tour guide, and it was supposed to be pretty much a junior tour guide, but pretty soon I was just running groups on my own and no problem. So these are museums that are near and dear to my heart, and that's why I like to continue supporting them and connecting people to that particular museum in history.
It's history for a reason. It lives on. You know, generations feel it, experience it.
That's right. That's right. And it continues to affect town. The schools are named after Nathan Hale. There's a monument in the cemetery. The British threw his body in the river, so it was never recovered. They just put a monument to his memory.
Wow. And,
but it's important we remember our history, one, so we don't repeat it, and two, so we know the foundation we're built and standing on, what was sacrificed and given so that we could have what we have today.
So this is a deeper question. Deep and kind of woo, but when I hear things inside, I say them. So there's something known as past life regression. Hypnotherapy can take you back, some believe, to other lives that we lived. Do you think that you were in another life or many from these periods? Yes, you were in a house, a home, raised, you know, that hundreds of years old, but do you think you might have existed back then in the 1700s and 1800s?
It could be. You know, I've had for many years, there was a back route we went to a horse tack shop, a real off the beaten path place. And along there was a small cove, and I just loved it. I kept telling my husband, I would just love a little cottage on this cove. I just think it's, and he goes, there's a million more beautiful places. Why this one? I said, I don't know. It calls to me. Many years later, doing research, I realized it was my ancestors that lived on that cove and started the first oyster farm in that body of water. And is there a reason I'm called to that piece of water and land so strongly? Mm. How it was 10 generations, 9 generations ago. I shouldn't know that in my heart.
This is what I'm saying. And, you know, I know this is kind of woo, and I'm, you know, the past life regression thing. I had one for the first time ever in June of this year, and I'm about 60% believing, but I always had an affinity for the 1800s. I want to say like 1860s, whatever. Loved it. I always love to look at photographs and all of that. I do this regression, and where do I wind up? Around that time period as a farmer with a horse. Now, I could have just made that up in my head under hypnotherapy. However, the things that happen in the visuals that I saw was extremely emotional. How would I and why would I even feel that unless it could have been real? Why? Like really deep, not that you just make it up. You feel it.
Yeah. There's an overwhelming power to it.
100%. So that for me, that gets me into like the 60%. This could be real zone. And, you know, further, I got to do it again. Let's see, you know, where it takes me or whatever. But I just find it fascinating. It's kind of fun thinking that maybe there's a connection. And what you just shared with that structure by the oyster farm, what are the chances? You know, are the chances?
There's not much there now. A couple little houses, a bar, an apartment house, you know, and just boggy marsh and the body of water. And I'm like, why do I wish I could afford a vacation house here of all places?
Of all places, right?
Mm. Yeah.
Because it resonates. It feels, you feel it. You feel a connection.
Yeah. I'm connected to that piece of land.
Yeah. For a reason. Interesting. Yep. Wow. Should we read something from the spooky stories?
Yeah. We don't realize we talk about our roots, but they're a real thing.
Yeah.
I think our roots really do have ground in place and time.
Even, you know, like ancestry.com or 23andMe, whatever, that can reveal stuff from your lineage too, because, you know, I don't know if I shared this, and I'm going to make this really quick. My affinity for the 1800s, I could look at photographs forever of the clothing. I'm like blown away. How do they make clothes back then that look like now and so tailored so well? And then I find out through ancestry.com that on my father's side, going back a few generations, I was Lithuanian. Didn't even know it. And my father's father's father was a tailor in Lithuania in the 1800s. What are the chances of that? And that has always resonated with me. And then he worked his butt off, brought his family to New York, And I actually was able to find the street in New York where he lived in the beginning of the 1900s. Why did I have a feeling a connection? And then it shows up on Ancestry. A little too weird, you know, coincidental. I don't think so.
Yeah. There's more to it than we believe.
Agreed.
So reading from 13 Spooky Stories and the Nathan Hale and Asher Wright story, there's been a sighting of a lantern at the Hale homestead from the Strong Porter Museum house. And the caretaker sees this lantern light up there. So he goes up to explore who's up there at night that doesn't belong. It's a snowy, snowy winter night and very dark. And there's no tracks. There's nothing. And he just can't figure it out. So he goes back down, he calls the police, they come out and look around. Then they see a lantern in the woods directly across near Asher Wright's. The police go to investigate that, and one of them falls into the foundation hole. And they see more lanterns. They stay up all night sitting there guarding the museum, and nothing. There's no tracks in the snow. There's nothing. If somebody had been there, they would have left prints. And yet they all saw the lights, and they don't quite understand. But the next morning, they come back to the museum to talk to the caretaker. "I know who it was last night," Ben said quietly, staring out of the window. The officer leaned over and looked out the window, asking, "What are you looking at?" Ben slowly raised his arm and pointed. "Across the road, there's a monument stone. Have you read it?" The officer shook his head. "The monument is to Asher Wright," Ben explained. "His house was over there. The cellar hole was his. He lived here in the 1700s. He was the best friends with a boy named Nathan who lived next door. They were hardly ever apart. Well, that was until Nathan went to college at Yale and Asher stayed home." The officer nodded, then said, "What does that have to do with the lights?" "It was a custom of the boys to meet on a full moon night to go off hunting or ice fishing or visiting. They each had farm chores to tend to, but when one was done, he would signal to the other that he was ready. Only when the boys were both done and both waved a lantern signal across the field would they gather their guns and powder horns and meet. There was plenty of game around here in the 1700s, you know, and plenty of good fishing down at the lake." The officer looked at Ben and scratched his head. "Are you suggesting that what we saw was..." And there was a long pause. Ben quietly replied, "I think so." So they go on to chat about it and have a cup of coffee. And as the officer is leaving, I'm just looking for the line here. Then Ben happened to look across the street at the woods just beyond the barway. He caught a glimpse of two figures walking into the pines, both dressed in colonial garb with guns slung over their shoulders. Then they disappeared into the trees. The police officer rolled down his window and looked back in Ben's direction. When their eyes met, Ben could tell the policeman had seen them too. Nathan and Asher gone hunting.
Hmm. What year around do you think that might be?
Probably 17. So the revolution was 1775. So pre-1775, and boys started hunting at 10 or 12. So yep. Somewhere in that 1765 to 1770 time span.
And when you said that they called the police, how did they do it back then?
So that is the current part, because that is a historical fiction. It was the caretaker's story. And reading snippets kind of is hard to tie those together.
Gotcha.
The caretaker currently was calling the police about seeing lights at the museum.
So I got it now. So this is a blend between current times and the history back then. Wow, that's so
right.
Cool.
And I love doing that.
That's so interesting. It really is. And you know what? Fun for you, I would imagine, because you have a foundation for the story, if you will, and then you add upon it by taking that foundation and making it modern.
Yep. And walking in both worlds simultaneously is exactly what I do in Christmas Letters as well.
Wow. Your other book. And by the way, a lot of the things there you mentioned in the story, you know, of the cold winter night, the snow, the absence of tracks, very dark. You know, many times when it snows, it's like at this ominous dark. That could have been in 1763 or now. All
right.
You know, it's all the same there. Same right. thing, same thing with the light. That light might not be a lantern. That might be just a regular light appearing from, but where is it coming from? Yeah, that could have been an abandoned building for years, decades, hundreds, and there's a light coming from it? Why? That's actually fun, writing stories like that.
It is. It's a lot of fun, and it lets your imagination go, and you just have to let it take the lead and see where it takes you.
I feel with the imagery of that story, I was walking there. I felt I felt that feel of the snow coming at you. You know, you're walking through, you're not seeing any tracks. You're wondering what's going on. It's dark. I felt like I was there. And then even just, you know, the foundation of the house. It's weird how your mind can shoot the movie, if you will.
Right, right. I'll do a little content. I hope to get over there before, while there's still enough light, that I'll do a little social media content too. Ooh. For tonight and from the locations.
This sound like doing that, there's so much you could do with that. You know, even adding to, you know, imagery of the building and such. What a fun event. Wow. We need to clone you in every state to do stuff.
Well,
like that.
I've done New York before, so
we need you back here.
Get a library to get me.
How do we find you, Carolyn? What's the best way?
My website is CarolynStearnsStoryteller.com, and you can connect to me through email on there. I have a video and all kinds of information on all the kinds of stories I perform.
And there is deep information there. There's your books. You've got downloads and lots of other stuff. Final question on the books. Is there something percolating on your mind in terms of writing another book?
There is. I have another novel almost ready to come out called Core, and it'll be about generational transition on family farms, two adjacent ones that are struggling with that, which is a constant struggle, but it could be any family business, and who gets it and how does that pass on, and who goes without is usually the more pressing question. Who's going to be hurt by the other one getting it? How do we divide it up? So I'm writing a novel about it because a lot of families just won't talk about it because they know it's going to bring up hard feelings. But I'm hoping a novel will get them to ask questions and consider possibilities.
All I'm going to say is I know what you're talking about.
Every family's got one of those stories.
Yes, they do. And there's, you know, as a friend of mine who's an attorney once said, pigs get slaughtered, meaning there's going to be somebody that is not going to be happy with the outcome. And they could have been done wrong by it, but it is what it is. Wow. What an interesting subject for a story. that needs to get told, or at least make us think about it.
Well, and I have a lot of questions for discussion in the back of the book that... You know, I'm hoping to get, there's questions for the older generation, questions for the younger.
That's a great idea too.
Families can maybe, please, just start having these conversations before something tragic happens and forces the play of hands and another farm turns into a development or a strip mall.
Or any business. Carolyn Stearns, storyteller.com. Thank you for today. Love what you do and have fun tonight.
Thank you. Thank you. Wish you were going to be there.
I wish I was too. I can't get there fast enough. We'll catch up next time. Appreciate it.
Bye now.
This is the Global Podcast Network, where executives and professionals connect, share, and inspire. Stay tuned for the conversations that drive success.
Let's go inside the mind of a 10-year-old.
I should have worn those earrings today. I like those earrings. Gabby has those awesome earrings. I need to ask her where she got those, but that's just what she would want me to do. I'll have Michaela ask her for me.
Buckle up, Sarah.
Yeah, but then Michaela will be like, why don't you just ask her yourself? That's just like Michaela.
Sarah, buckle up.
Michaela's such a great name. I wish I was called Michaela. There's like a dozen Sarahs in my class.
Hey, we're not hitting the road until you buckle up, honey.
Oh, yeah. Seatbelt. I forget sometimes because my brain is, like, busy, you know? I wonder if there's pizza at school today.
Sometimes it can be tough to get through to your kids, but it's not impossible. Always make sure they're wearing their seatbelts, even on short drives. Remember, you have the keys, you have the power. Never give up until they buckle up. A message from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council. Visit safercar.gov/kidsbuckleup for more information.